This is an example of speech.
All our history of broiling.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think. A no strings attached and no additional charges, exclusive and inclusive, educated yet speculative, often evergreen topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, social media, culture, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comments section in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis, and I have with me, as always and forever, my friend Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at Green_Weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we have our weekly intro segment, Weak Thoughts, a discussion of the civil war in Syria, and a grown-up book report of The Storm Before the Storm. Prepare to get riled up and righteous. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now for some weak thoughts. Those who benefit never ask why. Just sit back and enjoy some cocoa beans and don't wonder what profit really means. All right. I'm sure there's a lot of weak thoughts that we have. Government shutdown just ended. There's a lot of NFL football type analysis of that going on right now. There was the women's march over the weekend. Jeff Sessions apparently testified to Robert Mueller last week. That just came out this morning. And Oscar nominations. I don't think we're going to do that segment, though.
Yeah, I don't really follow the Oscars. I don't like the Academy's taste in movies.
I don't think I've seen... No, I saw The Post. That might have been up. And Get Out. I mean, that's my vote. What do you want to do first?
I guess let's do the horse trading. 19 Democrats voted against that. Not even the majority of them. Why would you negotiate for a weak promise from a guy without a chin?
It would have been nice if they would have, like, done a press conference and like, had all the cameras on McConnell and, like, made him make this promise very clearly and plainly in front of every camera in the world.
They should have done a joint press conference if they were, you know, going to be so behind their deal, but
yeah.
Instead both sides were able to go to their own cheerleaders and say what they wanted them to hear.
Well, I don't think it's entirely what the Democrat base wanted to hear, but
I'm just mad that they caved. I mean, if they're going to make a point about something, make a point about something, you know?
Yeah, I've heard some analysis of this that, you know, kind of covers, you know, oh, there's still time for them to make the deal. That's, you know, now they can actually do that. And the other side is like, well, why didn't they just do
make
that?
The deal.
Yeah, why didn't they just make the deal? But also on that other side is the, I almost wanted to say wild card, but it's the totally expected, predictable card, actually, which is the House Republicans.
Yeah, they're going to...
I think we all think that, give or take, you know, a concession here or there, the Senate can iron out a deal. They've done it in the past on immigration.
Right, they're eager to cut a deal.
And I think there's easily 60 senators, although I think McConnell said this would just be a majority vote. But anyway, either way, there's easily 60 senators, or close to it, that I think support DACA. But these House Republicans are raving mad.
And, hardline ideologues.
Yeah, and I don't think they're going to... supposedly, there's enough votes in the House if it came up, because you'd have a minority of the House Republicans. But what is it called? The Hastert Rule, where Paul Ryan has this policy that I guess predates him, going all the way back to what, that pedophile?
Dennis Astor,
just get that out there. That the House doesn't bring up votes if they're in, if the Republicans are in control, they don't bring up a vote unless the majority of their caucus supports it. So presumably that means the House won't do this now.
So if even if the Democrats had a good idea that the Republicans had no fucking ownership of, they wouldn't allow it to come to a vote.
The Democrats would have more to stand on today that it was a good decision to make if they could have not just gotten whatever they little they got out of McConnell, but gotten the same thing out of Ryan, saying, I will bring it to the House. I will bring this vote up.
Yeah, I don't think they got anything out of him.
No.
So, however much McConnell wants there to be a deal, he was negotiating in bad faith because he probably can't bring it about.
And, of course, he can't predict what the president will want.
I mean, I'm pretty sure they're just ignoring him at this point. He's already proven that they can't include him in negotiations, or else he'll just try to take the ball and go home.
I personally am less willing to criticize the Democrats, give them a chance. In the end, this is going to be unpopular for Republicans if they don't protect the Dreamers. There will be news stories the rest of the year about Dreamers being deported. Oh, you know how I want to start off this? We're already a few minutes in, but the point I wanted to start off this discussion with is just to make sure we're all on the same page. A Dreamer is not an illegal immigrant.
No, they've got...
They aren't a citizen, but they are not an illegal immigrant. They are following the current law as it stands.
Yeah. I mean, they may have come into the country illegally, but their status has been kind of...
Well, as a child, illegally, though. Yeah. That's the whole point.
I'd like to also point out the misnomer that not all of these people are Hispanic. Refugees and immigrants from Asia who did the same thing, and Africa, who are also under this Dreamer class.
That's an important point to make, although wanting to treat them as murderous illegal immigrants is racist no matter where they come from. I would argue. I just can't stand the hateful, cynical, lying propaganda war happening against these people. It's so heartless, and I try so hard to, you know, not necessarily compromise my beliefs to those of the conservatives or Republicans, but at least try and give them the benefit of the doubt of being human, and then they pull shit like this, and that becomes a very untenable position.
They should hang McCant or McConnell from that terrible and disgusting tweet that he put out over the weekend during the shutdown.
I don't know what it was.
He presented a choice between, like, the 8.8 million children that are covered under the CHIP program and, like, what, the 700,000 to 800,000 children who are protected under DACA?
Yeah. Okay. I saw that. I did see that.
That's disgusting. How aren't more people talking about that? And that's, like, obscuring the choice of, like, shall we say, healthcare programs that they just chose to ignore. Like, the community healthcare centers covers far more people than either of those, and it's just getting ignored and left in the dirt. Because we haven't been talking about funding those, have we?
No. I mean, the Republicans act like they gave the world to the Democrats by including CHIP. They're like, whoa.
Jesus fucking Christ.
It's like,
just because it's a big compromise for you assholes.
Yeah, and it's... Like, that shouldn't even be a big compromise.
Hey, I'm human.
Yeah. It's like, but that's not enough. That's nowhere near enough. I don't want to say I've never seen them act this insensitively, this heartlessly before. I'm sure they have. But this is really, this is...
I came up with a joke. At least in the 19th century, the nativist immigrants called themselves the know-nothing, and now we have the nativists who genuinely know nothing.
Oh, yeah, but they act like they... I saw Mark Short, the White House legislative, I don't know, whatever the hell he is. He's that bald guy who goes on the shows a lot. And he has, like, really big bottom jaw canines. It's terrifying. it's terrifying. I'm like, he was on the shows, you know, he's really adept at spinning the White House position to make them seem competent and knowledgeable, which they are neither. But he specifically was talking about Stephen Miller and responding to Lindsey Graham's statements about Miller, you know, obstructing any progress on this issue. And, right. And he said, like, Stephen Miller knows a lot about immigration. He is very knowledgeable on the subject. And he may be knowledgeable in that he knows every way to racistly spin every aspect of immigration. That's not actually being knowledgeable on the subject.
No. He just has polished talking points and the ability to speak with a snooty accent.
Oh, God, the way he talks is the worst. excuse me. So the shutdown, I mean, since last week's episode, I was a little right in that they'd hold their ground and take it to the shutdown, but you were right in that by the time of our next show, they were going to mostly give in, although they do have a couple weeks, so we'll see.
So I guess we're both right.
Yeah.
I
don't think I have any worthwhile predictions on this. I think actually a lot of it could go well. It's just those House Republicans again that are going to be throwing a wrench in, unfortunately.
My prediction is that they're going to, the House Republicans primarily, are going to hijack this quote unquote neutral and unquote immigration debate and turn it into a wish list of everything they want, and when the Democrats like try to resist, they'll turn it into a big political ploy and end up getting everything they want from a bipartisan group of senators.
Without protecting the Dreamers?
No, I don't think that's going to ever come about. I'm pretty sure all those kids are probably going to be deported.
I don't think there'll be a law passed by both a law that gets all the way to the president and signed that does not protect Dreamers and that is drastically more draconian. I could see something that's way more harsh on an immigration that protects the Dreamers, which in the end is, it's a really tough position because the Democrats have put kind of all of their eggs in the basket of protecting the Dreamers, which is a worthwhile cause for sure. It's something that has broad support amongst the people and is just so humane at its core. It's the right thing to do. But because they've thrown all their eggs in that basket, that sort of shifts in their attempt to gain leverage on this issue that is popular and humane. They've given leverage back to the Republicans, kind of like the chip thing,
mm-hmm.
where okay, they'll get the in the end, the Republicans I think will give in on that. They've all said in the past how they're for it, but they're going to take every last thing they can get until then. Family migration, you know, the family, whatever they call
chain
it.
Migration or whatever they want
to
call it.
Try not to use that term, though.
try not to use that term.
It's just that they're insidious propagandas in my head, and that's the only term I know, even though I know the other term. It's drowned out by fucking chain migration. Anyway.
But that's the kind of stuff that they're going to try to put in that immigration bill.
Yeah, they're going to do that. They're going to, make it way more merit-based. I bet they're going to
disgusting and like classist.
Yeah, they're going to change law. This is going to go beyond even this. They're going to change laws on, or at least attempt to change laws on, like refugees. You know how they're sending back those Salvadorians who were here because of an earthquake. They're going to change shit that prevents stuff like that happening. Political asylum.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about with the House Republican wish list.
Yeah, it's going to be all of that. And the problem is that if yeah, they're just in the end going to say, yeah, but we're protecting the Dreamers, and the Democrats won't sign this now. They won't vote for it. Because the Democrats might be pushed so far that they can't then vote for it. And and then in the end, the fucking Dreamers are going to be deported. It's
yeah, they should have, as I said, they should have taken a more principled stance now so that they would have more ground to stand on later in the negotiations. They've caved in almost every conceivable way, and now they're going to be begging to get something or anything out of any future legislation. Like when it comes after immigration is done and they start doing in what they call entitlement reform.
Okay, just one horrible thing at a time now.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I a political thing that might maybe would change things in the Democrats' favor is that some of these people who are going to be wanting to run for president, and I know this is like sort of a cynical way to look at things, but hey, it's politics. I mean, you have to do that. Some of these senators that are going to be running for president, or even if they're not running, are trying to kind of position themselves as an important voice in the party leading up to the presidential election, or even ones that are going to be primaried in this upcoming year. They have to, that's starting now. I mean, it's 2018, elections in 2020. By the end of this year, if they're going to be running for president, they're probably going to be finalizing.
They have to have their committees ready.
Yeah. And so throughout this legislative session, they're going to be positioning themselves, making big speeches. I don't know. It seems unlikely at this point, but hopefully some of them are, you know, rhetorically sound and charismatic enough and can actually make a dent on things. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But maybe that cynical way of looking at politics could actually be something that helps people. I don't know.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, I admit probably Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and some of the other 19 probably voted that way only because they're trying to appeal to the base.
Yeah.
But that's... I just love how everybody is afraid. The Republicans are so afraid of their base, and the Democrats won't do anything to, like, even just throw a bone to their base.
I'm not going to give recognition to whoever I read on Twitter that said this, because I don't remember. But someone on Twitter said, the Republicans are super afraid of the Republican base, and the Democrats are super afraid of the Republican base. And the Democrat base is just viewed as like viewed as like a monkey on the back of the Democrats. Mm-hmm. It's like something they just have to deal with.
If not for that base, Hillary Clinton would have been elected.
You know, this is kind of a broader problem with the Democrats, that it's true that they do vote with the GOP base, and by that I mean white men, mostly. Middle American white men.
Capitalists.
They vote with them in mind. And I think that is the hard-to-separate racism and sexism ingrained in the party. They can't help but think about those people because so many of them are those people or were those people or have connections to those people that the media portrays those. I mean, the New York Times still comes out with articles like fucking all the time talking about Trump voters.
Yeah, they devoted their entire editorial page the other day to just Trump voters. It's like, why don't you talk about the Democrat base? And why does it have to be by political opinion? Hell, do it by, shall we say, income level. Turn your entire front page over to people who make $25,000 or less a year.
That would be fascinating. That's ingenious and novel. We will not have it at the New York Times. We know what they think. I mean, I don't want to shut them out of political discourse. Like, that's wrong. I mean, that's a wrong thing to do. I believe in free speech. I believe in hearing people. But we know what they think. can we please hear from someone of color, someone that's poor, someone who's...
What about, let's talk to some probably 68-year-old grandmother who's probably raising grandchildren and is coping, shall we say, with the effects of the opioid crisis.
She has a political opinion. Well, I want to know it.
Exactly.
I mean, there's this... It's just so... Yeah, it's like the New York Times thinks, oh, because we have, quote-unquote, liberal establishment people on our opinion page most of the time, that means we have to, you know, think of the other side. The other side doesn't have to be Trump voters. What about...
Like people who can't afford the New York Times.
Yeah, people who aren't establishment. Like, it doesn't... it's so dumb. It's so dumb. They're so in their bubble that their only idea of what's... They just have no concept of what's outside the bubble. They think everyone outside the bubble is a Trump fucking voter.
Everybody outside the city is, right? If you live in a city, or if you live outside a metropolitan area, or in a city that lies less than, shall we say, 75,000 people, you're probably a Trump voter. Or you're just too poor and marginalized to matter.
Okay. So the Women's March was this past weekend.
Yeah, that would talk about a success story. I've never seen a huge crowd like that in the Washington Mall.
And all over the country. Particularly of interest was seeing the crowd sizes in some of the cities that, you know, maybe the city is kind of more liberal, but the area around it as a whole is. So, like, you know, obviously Austin might get it, but somewhere in North Carolina had a huge crowd. I think it was maybe Nashville, I think, had
Tennessee.
Yeah, that had a big one. It was inspiring, yeah. New York had a massive one, as you, I guess, would expect.
Right.
They were all New York Times columnists.
It's the biggest employer in the entire state. Yes.
According to the New York Times. That, it, you know, it's kind of interesting that occurring during the shutdown.
I'm surprised the Democrats weren't able to gain more political capital off of that.
Yeah, it's like they were too busy just reading... like opinion articles of people criticizing them about the shutdown than actually seeing the base face to face and what they wanted. What else happened this past week? As I said at the beginning, Jeff Sessions talked to Robert Mueller last week.
Wow.
That is probably bad for that crowd. We know he's a bad liar.
Yeah, I wonder how many times he said, I have no clear recollection of that, Mr. Prosecutor.
He's trying to invoke executive privilege, and Mueller's like, no, fuck no.
That doesn't qualify to criminal investigation, sorry.
Yeah, supposedly in the article I read, it said that Sessions is a witness, not...
not a target.
Yeah, but I don't... Until I hear that from Mueller himself, I don't...
Right? All of this is just speculation. Yeah. We're just looking through a keyhole and guessing what's happening on the other side.
It's actually even worse than that. What a lot of these reports about who Mueller has talked to, what they've talked about, what the, you know, when they quote people saying, you know, two sources close to the investigation say that Mueller is now focusing on blah, blah, blah. A lot of time that comes from people who have, or people close to, people who have been questioned.
Oh, so they're trying to use the questions that they were asked as some kind of guess as what... Yeah. Don't try to do that with a sphinx. He's not going to let you know what he's thinking about.
Yeah, so, I mean, on one hand, well, yeah, the questions are the questions, and... You know, a good interpretation and analysis could probably get you somewhere. But it's also inherently guesswork. I don't think, as far as I know, there are not sources inside this inside the Mueller team itself.
No, there doesn't seem to be any leaks. That guy, I would definitely want him to run a ship.
Oh, yeah.
No leaks.
Yes. There are people who... I think there might be sourcing sort of surrounding it. So if he's using other federal departments to get information, say, like
the FBI.
Yeah, or the Department of the Treasury, you know, whatever. Even if they were maybe going after some of the intercepted stuff in the NSA or, you know, whatever it was. So that could give clues as to what he's doing, and I think some of that stuff is getting sourced to the media, but it's still all, like, it's like you're just looking at, it's like everything around the shape itself. You're looking at just, you know, you're trying to piece it together, and you have, like, almost like a silhouette of the investigation.
I got these long, smooth bits, but it seems to end in a point. What do you got over there?
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, I don't know. There's not a lot to say on that. I just think it's funny thinking of Jeff Sessions, the up-jumped attorney general, sitting there being grilled by Mueller or whoever else on his staff.
And, looking like the tiny little man he is.
Yeah, you know, Kate McKinnon playing him. Like,
Jeff Sessions and Robert Mueller, what can she do?
Yeah, that was a weird impression, but I think she got the spirit of, like, the comedic impression of him. Just that confidence. Because I think dude has confidence. He has no reason not to.
Yeah, he seems supremely confident, but I'm not quite sure I share her opinion that that guy already has something that's a silver bullet to put down this grotesque werewolf.
We don't know. The rest of his path. We have no idea. I mean,
there is no logical, there's no reasonable conclusion to make off of any of the information available.
Yeah. The only conclusion to make about the Mueller investigation is that he should keep doing it.
He's making a lot of people very nervous, and that's so fun to watch.
That's true. I just wish you could, like, I just wish we had, like, a being John Malkovich type view into Trump's head. Where you could sit there and watch him get nervous over, you know, reading news reports and shit.
I couldn't stand to read or watch that much Fox News.
That's true. You would have to have that on in the background at all times. During food, during meetings, you're supposed to be paying attention to your presidential daily briefing and you're on Fox and Friends. By the way, what time does Fox and Friends end? Because I think that has a lot to do with this, quote, executive time in the morning where he doesn't actually do anything until 11, and that's apparently when he takes the presidential daily briefing, which is a little insane. Supposedly, I know the example I heard was W would take it at, like, 8, 9.
Oh, yeah, that guy's an early riser. He showed up to work, like, bright and ready every morning.
Yeah,
well, and so, probably not so bright in the later years, but...
And so the guy who gave it... They have to get up and get to
like
the office.
In the morning.
Yeah, they have to get there many, many hours ahead of time to put this all together. So they have, like, really weird hours. Probably part of the reason they only do it
almost
the
end of his day.
Yeah, so Trump's watching Fox and Friends before his presidential daily briefing. Fine, you want to watch Fox and Friends. Could you just do that first? And then watch, like, a, you know, maybe a little delayed broadcast of Fox and Friends? So at least you're viewing...
Yeah, he DVRs it, right?
Sure. So you can at least view it in through the lens of knowing real information.
But he doesn't trust the information that he's getting from, like, the bureaucracy and the rest of the government. Like, he only trusts those Murdoch horses.
The weird thing is that Murdoch thinks he's a dumbass.
Like, Murdoch knows he's not telling the truth. He's got to, right? He's too rich to know better.
Oh, fuck yeah. He doesn't care.
He just doesn't care at all, right? Yeah.
That's... I can't... You know, how were we raised? What's wrong with our parents that we give a shit? I mean, come on. Like, why can't I be heartless and callous and cynical and not care about lying or others lying?
And just robbing people blind. It seems so much more lucrative and easy.
Right? It's like, that's my one... Nah, screw working hard, being educated.
You tell people the right thing, they'll give you they'll give you their productivity and money for nothing.
I mean, I guess I understand a little bit of lying in politics. You know, a little bending of the truth, but... to sit there and run the news network that the president watches and then spreads lies of, or the fact that Murdoch, who apparently didn't even really like Roger Ailes, but let Roger Ailes run it and just spread disinformation constantly for decades, and he's cool because it's kind of his worldview, because it's kind of conservative, and he makes money off it, I guess. I mean, what are Murdoch's kids going to do? Murdoch's not going to last forever. His kids are apparently liberal, but...
I thought his children were involved in the media company, too.
Oh, my God, so they're even worse.
Yeah, I think one of them sits on the board of International News or News Corp, whatever it is.
Maybe they, you know, maybe they're just outvoted. They just don't really have say. I don't know. I don't know the inner workings, but that it's horrifying.
But who even qualifies as a liberal anymore? Jarvanka were liberals before this whole thing started.
You know what I read about that? One of the critiques in the Michael Wolff book is that no one says Jarvanka. They all say Javanka. Like, the fuck, who cares?
Yeah, right.
So, they still say something that's a lot like it. That's, you're missing the headline here.
And the real takeaway is that there is a stupid pet name for the two of them, or at least a derogatory name.
Yeah, around the White House.
That is openly used in the White House.
Yeah. Any other news from the week you want to go over?
Oh, I mean, it's tough to keep track of the news weeks anymore because so much is happening in just a deluge. Oh, Dan Rather is going to have a half-hour weekly show on the Young Turks.
Oh.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
A web-based weekly news show. I'll definitely be watching to see how it goes.
Yeah. Oh, I mean,
I was a huge fan of his, and I thought they really railroaded him out. I mean, compared to, what was it, that guy took a month-long suspension for lying in a much more dress, or, you know, what was that?
I mean,
do you remember that? Yeah, there's so many people who have just been sidelined for way less.
Well, I mean, Dan Rather, I mean, actually, you know what, a good analogous situation in terms of, like, the position of the person would be, you know, because a lot of these writers get, like, short suspensions when they have something that's a mistake. But, you know, it's like they, no one knows who they are, really. Like, most people don't read who the writer is in a New York Times or, you know, a written piece.
Yeah, but, I guess you have to be a geek like me.
Yeah, but Brian Williams, isn't that the guy, Brian Williams?
Right, that's the one I was thinking of.
He lied about being in a helicopter that was shot at in Iraq?
Yeah, and he was not, in fact, under fire like that.
He did get kicked off his show, but he, after, what, a year or less, got... he now hosts a show late night on MSNBC.
I mean, I guess that's less prestigious than his anchor position, but yeah. I don't know why they would ever trust him again. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't think what Dan Rather did was actually untruthful, like, in that respect. Like, Brian Williams outright lied.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. Wasn't the Dan Rather thing is that he just had a photocopy of the...
Yeah, not the actual document like he thought he did, but...
And so, I guess it could be forged, but couldn't just...
I mean, I guess he was misled. Yeah.
Yeah. And that, you know, but that was an effective way to just totally neuter the whole story.
Right, it kept Bush in office longer.
Well, that was before 2004, right? Not...
I think that was... Maybe it was after.
Well, no, that was leading up to an election. I know that. It got drowned out by Swift Boat Veteran.
Oh, yeah, it was 2004. You're right.
Yeah. Huh. It's interesting that didn't come out before 2000, but...
I mean, it did. That was always kind of... Everybody knew he was kind of draft dodging by taking the position as a pilot in the Texas Air National Guard.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
But at least he joined the Air National Guard and didn't get 5 deferments.
Okay, yeah, so let's end on that. Who is that? Senator
was it?
Tammy Duckworth?
Yeah, yeah, a veteran. Tammy Duckworth of Illinois.
A veteran.
I will not have a five-time draft dodger tell me what's good for our military. Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
Right on. That is... that. Hey, if that doesn't give you a little hope about the Democrats, that they have a veteran out there...
But she's new. She was just elected.
Yes. But essentially saying, F you to the president. How dare you... I mean, because imagine if it was the, you know... I'm sure we've seen at some point, though I can't think of a specific example, it going the other way. With some, you know, John McCain type, you know, speaking about, I don't know, a Bill Clinton military decision or something like that. You know, I was in the military, and I know more about this than you.
Oh, and Chelsea Manning, how are we forgetting that news?
Oh, yeah, she announced she's running for Senate and then went to a white supremacist rally.
She was trying to crash it, yeah, and then the video was spun.
I know.
Yeah.
It still was a weird move.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can understand. She should have been outside protesting and not trying to crash it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why you would go to a Mike Cernovich event to begin with, other than to, like, I don't know, throw tomatoes? But no, don't actually throw things at people in protest. Just wave your signs emphatically.
Yeah.
Also, wait, I just thought of a couple of other things. The thing in Florida. But I guess...
did someone stick their dick in something weird, or what?
Sort of. The ICE agent in Fort Lauderdale, who went on a bus and asked people for their citizenship papers.
Oh, yeah.
And was seen detaining a woman.
Yeah. This ICE stuff, this is our warning.
It's like, this is what they're willing to do.
They're the front line, I think, of how if unregulated, a Trump administration and his ilk would run law enforcement as a whole.
Yeah, I think so. I'm surprised they're not doing checkpoints yet, but I guess I probably shouldn't have said that aloud.
That's a great idea. What? Who said that? They're not listening to us, are they?
Speaking of Tom Cotton, it came out this week that his office sent cease and desist notices to people that were, quote, harassing, unquote, them. Or they were threatening to refer people to Capitol Police for harassment charges for contacting them so much.
Yeah, I mean, didn't Capitol Police just send them some letters, though? I don't think Capitol Police actually wants to do anything about it. I'm sure it's tenuous.
There's, like, grounds. There's laws that say that you should be, that you basically have to be able to petition your government. Like,
oh, yeah.
If somebody tries to contact their congressperson, the only thing the congressperson can say, especially if they're opposed, is thank you for your opinion and have a nice day. But they still have to listen, accept the letter, you know?
Yeah. That is... hopefully that doesn't go any further. Whatever that is. Whatever that was, whatever the impetus was, I don't know if he hoped for it to fly under the radar. I don't know. Or his office, at least. Hopefully we don't start seeing pushback against people calling their senators and writing their senators.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
You know what else happened this week? I don't think it's been resolved yet, but it came out that the FBI, I believe it is investigating the governor of Missouri for blackmail.
Oh, right, for blackmailing that woman who he was having an affair with.
Yep, did you read about, a couple weeks ago, the husband came out, and he's like, I want to get in on this before anyone else hears about it. And everyone's like, what? Get in on what? And he had been contacted by law enforcement and some media that I think were hearing things but didn't report on it yet.
Probably didn't have enough sources.
Yeah, and so he had recorded a conversation with his then-wife about her affair with the governor. She told him what happened, and this guy is, like, fucked up. He's a big family values guy. He tied her up, took pictures of her, and said, if you ever tell anyone, I'm going to, I don't even know what he's going to do, release the pictures. Like, by the way, how would that get you out of the jam? So she goes to the public and says, I had an affair with the governor. And everyone's like, oh, oh my God. And his response is to release naked pictures of her? That only proves the allegations. That's the worst blackmail ever.
All right, well, that's like the final suicide trigger. Like, I may not get out of this, but neither will you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a good way of negotiating.
No, like, you couldn't think of something a little more clever? Like, that's grounds enough for impeachment. Like, you're just really bad. I mean, at least fucking Trump's hush money, he's using hush money for Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, at least that's the same, like, kind of thing that...
making him sign non-disclosure agreements, getting the lawyers involved. You know, it's a competent operation. It's his most competent operation.
It's still kind of incompetent because now they're... like, because this is the same kind of stuff that sent John Edwards up. Like, he almost got, like, convicted of similar improprieties, or for similar improprieties.
They used campaign money. Is that what his problem was?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Use campaign donations, and that's why they're trying to figure out where that $130,000 came from, because Trump is known not to pay legal settlements.
What a piece of work.
Yeah, right.
Go around putting gold on everything, but you can't pay $130,000 to a porn star that you fucked around the time that your son was born? Really? Can't do that? Can't just spend the money? You have to steal it from a campaign fund or some other bullshit?
And he's making the evangelicals. I loved Pence. I wish I could have seen the video, but Pence defending it. Like, oh, these Stormy Daniels allegations are...
baseless, yeah, was baseless. His word. Yes, the guy who is on tape talking about how women react to famous rich celebrities and what you can do to them, who has been on Howard Stern dozens of times talking similarly about womanizing and all the women he's slept with and all of this, who's noted to be a playboy, hanging out with other billionaires, fucking women left and right, has told stories on the record, was talking to the Boy Scouts about how great it is to be rich and go on sex cruises and shit. Yes, it's baseless. It's baseless. Does he know what the word baseless means? It's one thing to just say not true, of course.
I mean, there is some basis in fact for these allegations, sir.
There's like a giant monolith base that just says Trump loves pussy. And that's the base. That's the base for the allegations. Yeah, he could have just said fake. Yeah, at least like Trump's going to be like fake news. Even Trump wouldn't have said it's baseless. Trump is way too proud of his womanizing to say it's baseless. He'd probably, like, wink and be like, not that I wouldn't do that, but this one's fake news.
Like, not that I would ever settle with one.
Oh, my God. What, did Pence think the story was about him or something? I mean, it's like, the worst word to use. I couldn't admit... So his grasp of the English language is Bushian, I guess. I don't know.
Well, he was a radio personality, so he knows what he was saying.
The method administration is not only about the president, it's about the different powers within this administration, the different lobbies that they're going to influence any president. So we have to wait and see when he embarks the new mission, let's say, or position within this administration as president in 2 months' time. But we always say we have wishful thinking that the United States would be unbiased, respect the international law, doesn't interfere in other different countries around the world. And of course, stop supporting terrorists in Syria. This is promising. But can he deliver? Can he go in that regard? What about the countervailing forces within the administration, the media, the mainstream media that were against him? How can he deal with it? That's why, for us, it's still dubious whether he can do or live up to his promises or not. That's why we were very cautious in judging him, especially as he wasn't in a political position before. So we cannot tell anything about what he's going to do. But if, let's say if he's going to fight the terrorists, of course we're going to be natural ally in that regard with the Russians, with the Iranians, with many other countries who wanted to defeat the terrorists. Whatever you please, for the night commuters in Uganda, the poor crack babies in Atlanta, for continents, the trash right Asians and transient Indonesian, housemaids from those who are never on the airwaves, the countless faceless horde of white slaves, bloody wars, fire patrol.
We beat ISIS, alright, end of segment.
Hooray, Syria's over, let's wrap it up.
No more problems there. Everything's nope. Just fine. Obviously, there's still war, straight up war there.
Thousands of American troops.
It's arguably, I think there's an argument to be made. It's become more. Factionalized than at least
balkanized.
Yeah, than at least the past couple years. I mean, right when it started, I think it was a little chaotic there, but. Now that ISIS has lost all of their major strongholds, there's no longer an everyone against ISIS mentality going on.
Right, now they're just trying to grab as much land as they can before the talking and tea party starts.
And so tell us about the news from the past couple weeks with a... What is it, a Kurdish militia, or what's going on there?
YPG, it's a kind of a civil defense group. I mean, a lot of these organizations in Syria have changed pretty rapidly over the last few years as to what, you know, they basically are. For instance, you have organizations like the White Helmets that sprung up to address, you know, civil emergencies and humanitarian needs in occupied and government areas, and then you have the American efforts, which weren't exactly coordinated, which is why I think we sponsored three different militant groups. Like, you got the YPG, which is primarily a Kurdish group in the north. You have the Free Syrian Army, which we kind of tried to stand up early. Then the Southern Front, which is along the Jordanian border, which is an entirely different military organization. And then you have the people that our allies sponsor, like Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Which, apparently, the Qataris didn't sponsor the right groups. I won't call them terrorists, but the right groups, because that inevitably led to the whole clash and the rupture in the Gulf this past year.
Qatar backed a group that the Saudis didn't like?
I think they backed Nusra Front at one point. It's kind of like an umbrella organization of radical Islamic groups that weren't ISIS, although some of them apparently went to ISIS.
Why all of the... Is it kind of just an influence grab going on here? I mean, why so many different cooks in the kitchen, but they're not just united against Assad?
That's a really good question. It's because they can't agree between them about what should happen, I think. Like, the YPG is apparently a radical left organization, but other groups have other, shall we say, religious identities, and the Free Syrian Army is kind of like a secular nationalist organization. Huh. And then, you know, you've got the Syrian government doing everything that they can to keep the rebels split and divided, like how they negotiate with certain groups and allow evacuations in certain areas, but not in others, and how they basically let ISIS destroy or absorb as many Islamic groups as they could. Then on the Syrian government side, you have like Afghani militias that the Iranians are sponsoring. You have Hezbollah, you have the Syrian army conscripts, you have Russian special forces and air support. It's a mix. It's a mix and a mess in any way that you would want to slice it. And then you have the Kurds, well, who have a kind of a pan-national struggle against Turkey and basically against the rest of the Middle East, trying to form their own government and, you know, sovereign area.
Yeah.
But the after the Kurdish minority in Turkey and the Turkish government ended their ceasefire that they had had in place, or a long-standing ceasefire, the situation became much more complicated, and now Turkey's attacking what they see as Kurdish bases of support across their borders. And they also probably want to dictate the rules on the ground for how this all gets settled up, in the same way that the Israelis are apparently doing around the Golan Heights, as was reported in The Intercept just this morning.
So is that, I mean, is that how Assad's, I mean, I know he had Russian backing, which is, you know, something big, but I almost get an impression he might still be standing, if not for that, just based on the fighting between everyone else.
I would say so, yeah. I mean,
at least it would have been a possibility. It wouldn't have been a slam dunk without the Russians.
Right.
For the opposition.
No.
Yeah. And then, not as easy for Assad. So the Russians have announced they were leaving, but they are still there, right?
Right. They're not we're going to retain one of their naval bases on the Mediterranean and an air base.
Oh, yeah, they're never going to give up a naval base
in
the Mediterranean.
They have strategic interests in Syria.
If for no other reason than just to have something in the Middle East, or is there...
Well, and the Mediterranean base is so key to their power projection and strategic defense.
Yeah, I mean...
Because that allows them to send their patrols all the way out into the Indian Ocean, potentially.
Well, because they have to, if worse came to worse, if they didn't have that, they would be locked in at
in the Black Sea.
They'd be locked in the Black Sea and then locked into the Baltic, because you have Sweden and Denmark controlling those straits. And don't those freeze over?
At least they do.
Occasionally. I think the Baltic ports aren't year-round.
No, and then they're cold water ports.
Yeah, so then, of course, nothing in north of Russia, obviously. Although that's becoming more useful.
Thankfully, thanks to climate change.
Yeah.
Some of those ports are becoming warm water ports suddenly.
Yeah, we're going to start seeing true northwest passages. And I think I heard last year the Russians sent a ship through the Arctic. Kind of just like testing out routes. It's not full. And of course the Canadians don't like that. Although I don't know if they have much of a navy to stand on to like stop the
Russians. Russia.
Yeah. It's a good reason to stay friends with America though, I guess. If need be. So that's really getting far away from Syria. Anyway, yes, naval base in Syria is important for Russia for important geographic reasons. Yeah.
Right.
So Turkey's getting in on this. They don't like the Kurds. And that's because they view the Kurdish people, who there are a lot in Turkey. I was just looking this up last night.
It's a sizable minority.
I was surprised. I was looking up Kurdish populations, that if you took them all together, it's like 40 million people.
Mm-hmm. Just splurred out all over there.
That's a big country. That's
more than
country.
Lebanon.
It's more than Syria.
More than Syria.
Syria has, I think, according to Wikipedia, it has 17 million people. I mean, there aren't more Kurds in Syria than the rest. I mean,
right. Syria is mostly an Arab Sunni country.
But if you took the Kurds from Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Turkey, which are all minorities in each country, but if you combined that, that would be bigger than other countries in the area.
Which is why all of them were against that sovereignty vote earlier this year.
All the other countries, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think it's just... Yeah, because that's the thing, is that it's not just that these countries want to, you know, don't want to lose that little bit of land that the Kurds occupy in their country.
They just want to kill the idea of Kurdistan.
Yes, that would be a suddenly, granted to be landlocked, but that would be a sizable country.
Landlocked, but sitting on all the major sources of water. That's right now they're on the rivers, east bank of the Euphrates. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
In the Tigris.
They'd have to put dams up for their energy, like Ethiopia or something like that. At the sources of the river.
Mm-hmm. Nobody would like that.
Interesting. So, is Turkey in Syria?
Yeah, I think they sent troops across yesterday or the day before.
I mean, how many armies are in that stupid country?
I think insane. 9? Based on my count.
And that's not...
Those are just national forces.
Yeah, and that's not counting the different local groups.
There's hundreds of them.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Who we've talked about don't work together. It's almost like the Mr. Burns getting sick thing. There's so many different groups that they're all stuck in the door.
Right. This started as a peaceful revolution that the government overreacted to and instigated a political insurgency, which then was sponsored by everybody who had extra money and an interest in kicking Assad out of power.
This started in the Arab Spring, right?
Yep.
Oh, God.
This has been going on for, what, 6 years now?
Eight, going on eight, I think. 2010, isn't it 2010?
Yeah. So
that's insane.
Yeah, and that's tens of millions of people are just fleeing their country. They're fleeing the Middle East because of it.
Yeah, to think that there's a... Not just after effects of the Arab Spring still happening, which, you know, is not surprising. Any big political event can have decades of reactions and after effects. But that there's still an ongoing thing happening that directly was started in the Arab Spring is just remarkable.
We should put some context on the front of this, too, and remember that Syria was one of the places that George Bush used for his extraordinary rendition program. So it's not like we were unfriendly with Damascus before this.
So why did we become unfriendly? Because of the overreaction?
I mean, at a certain point, maybe the Obama administration thought that they no longer needed a Syrian partner, and maybe the overreaction, but I don't know. It seems, well, I guess this whole case, to my mind, is a reason why, if there is foreign intervention, it should be coordinated, perhaps through a supranational organization like the UN, rather than piecemeal, where everybody's sponsoring their favorite militia and just giving them guns and money and see what happens.
Yeah, clearly that's not working well.
I mean, if they had just put in a UN peacekeeping force, even in, like, the first 2 years of this... I mean, heck, even have, like, Russian-American troops and U.S. peacekeepers or UN peacekeepers on the ground to make sure everybody feels comfortable with it, but it would keep them from shooting at each other. Like, almost all of Syria has been leveled.
Was there any effort to do anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of.
So
I don't remember.
Because
they, you know, they saw a crisis and they all wanted to take advantage of it. And unfortunately, that means a lot of people's lives were destroyed.
You could see, though, like if everyone had to go back in time, that's maybe what they would do. Since they're all there anyway, you know, at least us and Russia are there anyway. And if it was to be just to keep the peace, how does that work though? If you're having large scale peaceful demonstrations to topple a regime, which is essentially their goal, I mean, or at least for heavy reform.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a third party in there keeping the peace. At some point, doesn't it still kind of have to come to a head? I mean, or just the guy who's in power just willingly leaves, which is...
I mean, we've had some pretty successful political stabilizations in Eastern Europe as a result of that those interventions in nation building. Yeah. The other example you could easily point to is the Chapter 7 UN peacekeeping force that's in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Like, they have authorization to carry out offensive military actions, but people are still protest Kabila in Goma and the other places where the UN peacekeeping force is based.
I mean, do they keep the peace fairly well, then?
Yeah, I don't... Like, unlike in Kinshasa, where I think, what was it, like 5 or 6 people were killed this past weekend when government forces basically counterattacked the people coming out of the churches and protesting.
So...
I mean, peace has... There has to be some kind of peace for any kind of political resolution.
Yes. But at least the Assad regime, presumably with Russian backing, although that's sort of being changed, but presumably for now with Russian backing, thinks that the fastest way to peace, at least, is to support his regime.
Right, and they've got other internal legal reasons for wanting to do that, too, because by the Russian perspective on this, or at least as far as I've gathered, I don't actually speak Russian myself, but they would view this as an internationalist legalist campaign. They're reinforcing the sovereignty of a state that was a UN member. So, yeah, it's very easy to appeal to international law for what they're doing.
How does that get affected? I mean, what if you brought up gassing their citizens or something like that?
Well, I mean, they're still using chlorine gas, apparently, so I don't know how much the Russians are really against anything the Assad regime is doing, but I don't know, it's something. Well, I'm not saying it's good, but that's their perspective. They're reinforcing a sovereign state.
Yeah. And I think you'd probably, I would venture a guess that that would actually get a lot of support in the UN.
Yeah. Sure, nobody wants to be overthrown.
Yeah, they're all thinking, or a lot of them would be thinking, that could be me.
Right.
So, what are the chances that Turkish troops come into direct conflict with American troops?
Unlikely. Right now, they're invading near Adlib in the western part, and most of our troops are deployed in the eastern, or Afrin, sorry, misspoke. Okay. Most of our troops are deployed in the eastern part near Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor, in the former ISIS areas, or, Daesh.
Mm-hmm. I assume, especially both countries being part of NATO, there are lines of communication to try to prevent that, even if things got geographically closer together, from happening.
Assumedly.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure Erdogan really cares at this point. It might be a good political ploy if he opposes the U.S.
Oof.
At least for him domestically.
Yeah. That's a scary thought.
But this whole, like, Fortress Europe ended up becoming Fortress Europe because of the Syrian crisis and the millions of refugees that they were trying to keep from their borders.
From European
Syria.
Borders?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, they made that huge deal with Turkey for population, or so that's the Turks would take the refugees and keep them from getting into Europe.
What does Turkey get out of that deal?
billions of dollars.
Nice, good old-fashioned pay and payoff.
Yeah.
Which is probably laundered into gold for Erdogan or something. So, okay. So we have a militarily tenuous situation. We have a lot of different cooks in the kitchen. We have a still strong, somewhat, regime with Assad.
Increasingly strong. They've pushed the rebels into only a few areas now.
To me, this seems like America leaves. Just exits. As long as we don't have the boogeyman of ISIS, I don't see why...
Why this particularly bad dictator is any more deserving of our attention than any other terrible dictator in the world.
Yeah, I'm almost thinking that within a few weeks he starts complimenting Assad on Twitter or something like that. Congratulations to Assad for defeating ISIS and helping us with the war on terror or something like that.
Rehabilitating him?
Especially if they have other places to go with these troops and equipment.
The 2,000 troops there? I mean, they would probably just send them into Iraq or Afghanistan, so... They're still in the area.
I think they just announced we're putting 1,000 more into Afghanistan? I think I heard
Seems like a drop that, in the bucket.
Well, it would be... I don't know the exact numbers there, but... What do we have there? Like 14,000 or something like that?
Right. Significantly less than we've had in previous years.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Anything else you want to talk about for this?
I mean, where does it go from here? The Russians are about, as I said, are leaving. I don't think Assad is going to allow a peaceful resolution. He's going to continue to grind out and destroy all of his opposition until he's the only one left at the top. Because that's how they've won this war, just through sheer ruthlessness. So, where does it go? As you pointed out, should the U.S. stay involved? I don't know. I would say not. Just because I'm a non-interventionist, but I don't think... Unless we're going to be there to deploy as a peacekeeping force, we don't really have any role. Unless you want to start putting troops between the government forces and the civilians, but that's taking a much different political stance.
Yeah, I agree. I'm almost surprised. There must still be some remnants of ISIS or what they think to be ISIS there.
Mm-hmm. I've heard like 10,000.
Okay.
And they still hold a few villages out in the Euphrates Valley.
Okay, so that there's going to be a concerted effort to wipe out the last of that. I don't know. Beyond that, I just don't see them lasting. And, because Trump talked about not starting... You know, I know campaign promises don't mean much to the orangutan-in-chief, but he did campaign on... not having a huge war there. And his bombing of that Air Force base last spring seemed like an escalation or going back on that promise. But it's not like it ramped up that much since then.
It was just a one-off warning, apparently.
Yeah. It was just a commercial for his foreign policy.
It made him seem so presidential, right? Isn't that the first time they said that about
him? Yep, that was the first time, and the next time was this stupid... joint session of Congress speech. What a bunch of... I don't think the Trump administration has any interest in amping up that war or doing anything to protect any citizens. So I would think they would leave pretty soon. I'm a little surprised they haven't yet. I guess they're just taking care of what these last few ISIS people.
Keeping our finger on the scales for whatever resolution happens.
Well, that's the thing. I mean,
maybe that's part of it, keeping things from being resolved by having our troops in the region.
Well, or just keeping an eye on. You know, because if the idea is ISIS started because there was all of this chaos caused, you know, kind of instigated by the U.S. going into Iraq, but exasperated by the Syrian civil war, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's all this chaos. ISIS comes up in there. I don't know, maybe having 2,000 troops sitting there at a base might prevent some of that from happening. Again, I don't know. I don't know if that's enough. I don't know if that might even hurt things. It gives a potent symbol of anti-Americanism if you have that base sitting right there. Might even be dangerous for them.
Right. And they're not going to reconcile, or the rebel groups aren't going to reconcile if they have continued American support.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. I don't see a pathway out of any other resolution than Assad exerting control and killing tens of thousands of more.
Or somehow coming to the realization that he needs to allow free and fair elections, but I don't even know what that would consist of in a war zone.
Well, a rigged election.
I'm like, hey, look, he got 97% again. In a country where he's like, what, the Alawites are less than 20% of the population?
That's his ethnicity?
Mm-hmm.
Alawite, yeah.
It's a minority Shiite ethnicity.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I don't know. Okay. We don't have any bright ideas, people.
There's no bright ideas. There's no brightness that's going to come out of this, at least.
Well, we'll keep an eye on things. Maybe we'll do a segment someday when we have a better plan
better
for
follow-up.
The future. Yeah, but...
I was trying to think of something to in preparation for this, but there's no good exit.
Yeah, it's not like 3 years ago where not saying there's a good exit at the time, but at least it was a different situation, especially before the Russians got so overtly involved. It could have gone a lot of different ways. I don't know if I'm in a position to say that we did the wrong things, though we probably did. But it just seems like it's not worth it to do anything more right now.
No, hopefully, well, I mean, in some case it might make Donald Trump in particular seem weak if he has troops there that aren't doing anything.
Hmm, yeah.
But that's just a projection.
Well, and even the scale down is probably, if they do it, will be under the radar and gradual. Because he's not going to go out and give a speech saying, all right, we're bringing everyone home from Syria because it's perfect there now.
Well, again, those are conventional forces. We also have a constellation of special forces bases across the region, or across Syria.
Yeah, and I think they're going to be that. If I had to guess, they would be pulled out slowly first. Again, this was after ISIS is pretty much gone. You pull them out slowly, reassign them to other places, and you leave those 2,000 troops there as kind of a show of presence. And trickle them away over a couple years. I don't know. The thing is, though, what if the ISIS people start more of a... I mean, aren't they already kind of moving more towards a guerrilla style rather than occupy strategy?
Yeah, they've sent a lot of their foreign fighters back overseas to help reinforce their foreign contingents, like, you know, Libya, Egypt, Philippines,
mm-hmm.
everywhere. And now they're just taking to the countryside, so It's going to be difficult. I don't think they'll ever truly be defeated in a conventional sense because it's no longer a conventional war.
Yeah, it'll be. They'll look more like Al Qaeda. In terms of
yeah,
being,
that's what they're trying to be.
Yeah, cell operated. They're no longer a caliphate.
Yeah, they don't control any territory anymore, except maybe arguably in northern Sinai.
So that tells me that something like the CIA would be heavily involved in managing ISIS, more so than conventional troops.
Managing our response to ISIS, not actually managing the people.
I didn't say that. Oh, wait. All right, let's get out of here.
How to write a book report.
Online book reports are very important.
Step one, read the book.
Now, you probably have this assignment from elementary school, so you're familiar with what a book report entails. You are responsible for one book report.
Step two, give the book report a creative title that includes the name of the book.
You will be responsible for two reports. Be sure to follow the format that's been assigned. Here are some tips. When writing your book report. When writing your book report, please use a pencil. Please make sure it is sharp so that it does not look messy or sloppy.
Give a brief analysis of the subject of the book.
Use the book to write it correctly. Remember the rules as we have been learning about important words to capitalize in a book title. Use that to reinforce some of the things that you are saying in your book report. Following these things, you have the option to write a summary. Talk about your favorite character, compare it to you, why or why you did not like the book, what was important to you that you learned, what was the theme, what was the lesson. You always want to start with a great opening sentence if possible, add several details, and then, this is just an example for me. You do not have to finish reading the book to write the report on that book.
So, we're going to do something, a new segment called Grown Up Book Report. I, this past week, finished a book written by Mike Duncan, who's a now legendary host of two podcasts. He did the History of Rome podcast and Revolutions, which is still going on. He wrote a book this past year, 2017. Oh, by the way, he lives in Madison. So that's cool. Anyway, it's called The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. It talks about the years of the Roman Republic between about 146 and 78 BC. And I would say the thesis of the book is let me step back from that a little bit and talk about, he actually talks about this and he has a little prologue, or an author's note, he calls it. And he sort of invites comparisons to America. He talks about how direct comparisons between current events and history are always troublesome because there's always going to be different context, different figures involved, different reasons societies, peoples, nations are doing things. But at the same time, a big reason you do learn about history is to inform your current events, your understanding and your actions in your current environment. And so he points out in the author's note that if there's going to be any comparison, or maybe one of the best comparisons you could make between where we are in America, in the history of America, in the timeline from our foundings to whenever our end will be, one of the best would be this time period in the Roman Republic, which is, for those who don't know, this book ends roughly, 30 years, 40 years before Caesar turns it, it essentially ends the Republic, turns it into an empire. The way he breaks it down in comparing it to America is that you're going to have a few phases in the life of any nation. You know, the founding, you're going to have the expansion, you're going to have the end, and you're going to have, like, the chaos before the end. Or not even, maybe chaos is too strong of a word, but the unraveling. And then you'll have, like, the peak in there. And he points out, we're obviously not in the founding. We're obviously not in the very end. You know, America's not going to end tomorrow. We're not in the expansion, because that would have been, you know, late 20th century.
19th century, yeah.
Late 19th, early 20th century. We're probably not in the peak, although that's, I think, he's on the edge with that. But we're probably not in the peak. So anyways, he invites that comparison in your reading of the book, which I thought was really interesting that he put that in the author's note, kind of giving you a way to think about current events and compare it to this book without ever bringing that up in the actual text of the book. He never once makes, like, it's a lot like this in American politics, which some history... I just started reading a book yesterday, and within the first, like, chapter and a half, he's comparing it to weird modern corollaries, and he's talking about things 1,000 years ago. Which maybe we'll do... I'll do that book some other day. So anyways, Storm Before the Storm, beginning of the end of the Roman Republic. The general thesis of the book is for hundreds of years leading up to when this book starts, there was a slowly expanding, yet somewhat stable, representative republic, although it only represented the rich and the aristocratic, for the most part. Aristocratic interests, for the most part. And they had something, I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation, Mos Maiorum, which is their sort of unwritten rules of civility, the way things are done. How, you know, kind of like rules of the Senate. You know, the rules of the Senate aren't written down in the Constitution. They're not amendments. They're just the way they do them. I mean, they are...
established norms.
Yes, established norms. We obviously nowadays with Trump see that a lot with the presidency itself. Well, but you're supposed to release your tax returns. Well, that's not the law. You can see in this book how those things not being explicitly written in the law are the first things to go. Eventually, laws start getting bended or just straight up ignored at some point over the decades that things unravel. And in the beginning, it starts with the Gracchi brothers. And they're the Gracchus brothers, but they call them the Gracchi. The Gracchi were these... Do you know about the Gracchi, Charles?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Not very much, though.
So they were these populists that were really worried about agrarian reform and land distribution and...
The Koch brothers of their day?
So, as I was reading the book, because of this invited comparison, it was hard to exactly lay down, which it can be hard to differentiate liberal and conservative now between fucking 30 years ago, much less 2,000 years ago. So, you know, there's differences. But I would call them more, they were more liberal. Now, they didn't have this term at the time of the Gracchi brothers. It came about a little later. But there were two different groups that you'd kind of call your liberal conservative. They were the Populare and the Optimate, I believe. And they were, you know, kind of your progressives and your establishment. It was an easy way to look at it. The establishment was more about the aristocracy and... You know, they would be more for Mos Maiorum unless it wasn't in their interest. They were constantly the ones aghast at anyone breaking these unwritten rules, but then if they needed to do it, they'd break it. So the Gracchi brothers are somewhat famous, and they, like, the first thing to go down that started breaking, unraveling, and you can see it just, like, slowly over these decades, just everything falls to shit, is Tiberius Gracchus runs for an office called Tribune for 2 times in a row. And that had never happened before. And he broke Mos Maiorum. But it's because he had these genuine interests in helping things and changing things. But people flipped out and he was literally murdered for it. So then you started seeing street violence. You started seeing mobs, mob rule. Except this mob was a group of establishment senators. So picture Mitch McConnell leading a group of Republicans it was like a table leg or something, and he beat the shit out of Tiberius Gracchus, beat him to death.
Wow.
All for running for the office of Tribune twice. Now, the way they had a bicameral legislature, sort of, and you had the Senate, which were, I don't think they were elected, they just were. They just were senators. And they were a relatively small group. And then you had the assembly, which were, you know, kind of like our House of Representatives is a way to look at it. I mean, supposedly the Founding Fathers knew of the way the Roman Republic was put together and run. And so we took some things from it. And the Senate would, or from the Senate, usually, though it wasn't written into law, you would have someone elected as two of them, consuls each year. And I believe anyone could vote for consul, if I understand the system correctly. But they almost always were already senators. And consuls often, technically they had a lot of administrative control, but they, in general, there was less executive power. So the Senate would run things. Most, like, foreign policy. But you'd elect these consuls, and they'd go have wars overseas, or they'd run this place. Or there'd be kind of an issue you'd give each consul each year.
Of a project-based position.
Yes, yes. And it would be a yearly elected position. And then you had something called the Tribune, which often came out of the assembly. And the Tribunes also had a ton of power. So the way laws were done is that they'd go to the Senate. The Senate would then talk it over and vote or however. And then they'd pass that off to the Assembly. And the Assembly would vote on it. Now, in the Assembly, though, a tribune would be the person who formally brought it to the floor. And so what Tiberius Gracchus did, he had these land reforms. And he knew the Senate wouldn't go for it, so he just said, screw it, I'm going to take it directly to the Assembly, because they're the ones that, in the end, make the actual law. So he went directly to the Assembly, and any tribune, I don't remember exactly, I think there were 2 or more tribunes at a time, any tribune could veto it coming to the floor for any reason. And so all these senators that were pissed off then blocked this coming to the floor. And it led to chaos. It led to Tiberius Gracchus's murder. And the last thing I'll say about the setup that is also a corollary to today is that part of the reason they were needing, or people thought they needed someone like a Tiberius Gracchus, a populist reformer, is because Rome had been having a lot of wars at this time. Wars with Carthage being the most recent big wars at that time.
Right, the 3 Punic Wars.
They had just destroyed Carthage at this right around the beginning of this book. And it just burnt it to the fucking ground.
Salted the earth.
Yeah, they're like, okay, enough of these things. They've been going on like a century or whatever at this point. But they also expanded at this point throughout Italy. They had Spanish colonies, Greek colonies. All of these had been years and years of wars. Now, the problem is that the way Rome would build its legions is that you'd have people who were landholders, and they'd pay money to be to get into the Legion. Now, the issue is, no one took care of that land when they left, and of their property. And so even if they did come back, it would be in disarray. Or they may never come
back. Tatters. Right.
And this land started getting bought up by the rich. By the rich. It was just kept getting into bigger and bigger groups. And they're... And then, you know, these former veterans or the families of the veterans would then come to Rome or other big cities. And so, but notably Rome. So you had this big poor population that was just working like wage slaves, kind of what we would call it today. But the problem with that is, as if that's not problematic enough, you also, because of the wars, were having hundreds of thousands of slaves coming to Rome and the farm country, the countryside estates around this time as well. So there actually also was then less work for the wage earners to do because they can't compete with slaves.
Interesting.
And they didn't have, you know, they actually, it is something that started to happen is that there would be something called a grain dole or bread dole that they'd give bread to these poor people in the city to keep them alive. Because otherwise, before that, you just died. Right, wow. Right in the street, no one gave a shit. Because even the church at the time, they didn't have, like, the Christian church, which in, like, later Byzantium would actually legitimately take care of the poor. That didn't really exist here. And so you had a troublesome situation with a lot of wealth inequality. You're having more and more trouble filling out your legions because there were fewer and fewer landholders to... And I believe you had to be a... I was going to say you had to be a Roman citizen. You didn't have to be a Roman citizen, but the problem is that someone who wasn't a Roman citizen joining the Legion could kind of take the spoils of war, but they didn't really get... It's not like they got citizenship. They couldn't vote. They didn't really have... Them and their families did not have say in the political situation.
So they didn't really gain anything from joining the Legion.
Beyond,
so they had less reason to identify with the state.
Beyond some loot. Yeah, correct. Part of what Tiberius Gracchus and the land reform was doing, though, was when they would take big chunks of the Italian countryside or, say, northern Africa, is part of the idea of this land reform was to then start colonies, to put colonists there, particularly, although I think this happened a little later, veterans of these wars. Some later generals started to take care of, they wanted to take care of these veterans. And the list goes on and on about how this breakdown occurs. There's a guy called Gaius Marius who became known as like the third founder of Rome, they called him. He was kind of a conniving, ambitious young guy. But he eventually became a great general with big victories in northern Africa and Gaul, southern Gaul, France. And he was one of the first ones to start taking people who didn't have land into his legions. And that's kind of then what led to him being a popular reformer, that he then wanted to make sure that these people were taken care of. And they knew, and he knew they were a voting base. It goes on and on, the characters in this book that either become, you know, sort of, their opponents would have viewed them as tyrannical, people seeking the tribune or the consul position. They all broke rules in their own way. This Gaius Marius became consul, I think, a total of 7 times before he died, which, that was another position you were only supposed to do once, but there was one guy who got voted into it 3 times earlier. But they were all for special situations, so they kind of bended the rules for him. And everyone was okay with that. But then when the Gaius Marius came around later, you know, they were more willing to then bend the rules. And then that eventually leads to people after him that are just like, no, I'm just going to be consul 7 times in a row, or whatever it was. I don't know if it was seven, but multiple times. And it just, you just see the breakdown of their political situation directly then leading to something called the Social War, which is like a civil war on the Italian peninsula. I mean, the scores of thousands of people that someone named Sulla, S-U-L-L-A, who was a political opponent of Gaius Marius, who eventually sort of reformed, although it didn't last, the Roman Republic after all this chaos. He led a legion right into Rome, you know, a generation before Julius Caesar. He actually was going to, he had Julius Caesar on this list of enemies that he created for execution, but Caesar had connections as a young 19-year-old, just enough to talk people in Sulla's midst for letting Caesar go. And he apparently said something along the lines of, you know, some prophetic quote about Caesar, like, oh, this kid's gonna, you know, I don't know. He's going to be trouble someday or something like that. But if you guys really want him to live...
Yeah, that guy must be a great judge of character.
Yeah, he was. He might have been. He was also... I mean, he like slaughtered and burned everyone in Athens as he had his own legion just doing his own foreign policy in the East.
Jesus.
I mean, it was madness. The book... The book's wonderful. It's a great, again, not a, it's not written with telling you, oh, this event in America's recent past or current events is just like this one in the Roman past. But it paints a picture that as you read it, you notice little things that seem really familiar. That just seem like, you know, as someone living through America right now, it just seemed like home. And then you see all the... I mean, as bad as America will get, it's unlikely to get as bad as... I mean, there are multiple instances of this Sulla guy just, like, gathering 6,000, 10,000 people together and killing every last one of them. I mean, just massive, massive numbers of dead. It's horrifying. But, yeah, so I don't know. Did you have any questions?
Well, it's... I mean, I'm glad that not the author like didn't try to make a lot of direct comparisons, but is there anything to take away from this? Like, how did the Gracchus were the Gracchus brothers successful? Would you say that?
So that okay. So that's a good question. So a lot of these reforms took place, and you may have seen some good come from it, but it was usually short-lived, because regardless of the policy, the political situation itself would become less and less functioning, or at least functioning with decorum and without violence, without street mobs, and just assassinations left and right. And... So, you know, even if our situation in our world isn't as bloody, I think the takeaway is that the stability of the politics themselves is important in and of itself. Because, so Tiberius Gracchus did not live to see his, he called it his land commission or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
His brother, who was a little younger, Gaius Gracchus, I believe took it up. And he was on the land commission, which did eventually get formed. They did do work for a number of years.
Was he later executed by Caesar?
Well, he would have been too old for that. This was a little earlier on. This would have been almost 100 years before Caesar's rise.
Oh, okay.
But he was, I believe, if I remember, driven from Rome and committed suicide as the mobs were running after him. He had his, like, servant slice his throat or something. I can't remember.
Populist backlash.
Yeah. There's a lot of back and forth. It's more and more extreme. It's just, you know, like that teetering thing. Every tip each way goes further and further and further. And, you know, it eventually just collapses into empire after the events of this book. Well, I mean, you'd actually say it collapses into a civil war at the end of this book. Which then, even though they reform the Republic, you see, he kind of gives a short summary of the kind of years between the end of this story and the beginning and Caesar, and how a lot of the exact same things, once it was all rebuilt, kind of the way it originally was... With some changes made to hopefully make it better, it all just happened over again, almost, you know, just faster. Instead of it taking place over 80 years, it took place over 15 or something like that.
Huh.
Including, like, the same rules. So you saw rules being broken throughout this book. They reform the Republic after all this civil war. They put a bunch of rules. They write them down this time. Within a few years, there are people voting to break the rules and change them and this and that. And, you know, I guess the legislature should always have the right to, you know, in our system, make amendments and things like that. But it doesn't seem like anyone learned a lesson, unfortunately. So, roundabout way, answering your question, yes, they did make a land commission. I think it was eventually neutered. A lot of the policy changes they talk about in the book occur... Like the person might be killed. It's not the last time you hear of that happening here. Where someone suggests a change, they push hard, they break a rule to make the change. Someone murders them because of breaking a rule and saying, "Oh, you're a tyrant." Then someone else rises up who kind of agreed with that person. They're a little savvier about it, and then they get the change done anyway. But then there's some sort of backlash, policy backlash, and it just keeps going back and forth. And so, to me, the takeaway is civility. And that's really hard. Like, I get, like, you read this and you get it. You're like, okay, I kind of get why they rile up against that guy. He's an asshole. How dare he do that? But that's why you have a republic, you know? That's... why it's not mob rule, I guess. Right.
So you're saying rules-based governance is more important than progressive policy?
Maybe not. Well, that's at least the thesis of the book. Hmm. You know, and you have to remember, this guy is right now doing a podcast called Revolutions. So he's well aware of... what leads to revolutions and the after effects of revolutions, including the American Revolution, which, you know, he's more or less a supporter of the American Republic. I mean, he likes the after effects of a lot of these revolutions, you know, and he doesn't editorialize it in his podcast, but, yeah, you can pick up on it that he's often sympathetic, to an extent, although the French Revolution's real troublesome.
Yeah, it's a real messy event.
Oh, that's just the worst. French Revolution is the worst. He's well informed about the breakdown in politics and the importance of rules and systems and what leads to these. Like, so... it's really easy to blame the populists in this book. You know, you could read this book and be ignorant and say, oh, it's all the populists' fault. They were trying to do the reform and they were breaking rules in the process. But he makes a point both in the beginning and the end of the book that it's not their fault. There was a rigid, conservative, elitist group that was refusing to try or do anything to help. And doesn't that sound really familiar to us today?
I mean
we spent the first part of the show talking about fucking Republicans just refusing to do the human thing,
right? Just refusing any form of compromise for fear of it weakening their position.
And that's so much like the Optimate or whatever group in the Roman Republic. So,
I mean, if anything, they had more to lose than even the Republicans do today. mean, it wasn't just political power. They had real power.
They had power. But even that was... It's not that if these reforms would have taken place, they wouldn't have had any power. They still would have been super powerful. And in the end, if they would have been willing to compromise and have some reform in a civil way, they could have kept their republic going, and they would have stayed in power, and their descendants would have not been murdered in the streets, or murdered at the hands of a tyrannical led legion invading Rome.
Huh.
You know?
Yeah, it's tough to say that. No, this was... Yeah, I guess compromise is better than the alternative.
But it has to it has to go both ways. Compromise has to be both sides.
Right.
And if there's one side refusing to compromise at all, I don't know what you do. Like I don't know if there's any good way out. Right, time for closing thoughts. What was that you were just telling me, Charles, about...
Comey was apparently interviewed by Robert Mueller.
Earlier on in the investigation.
Right. Or questioned for hours by Robert Mueller's team. This is being released even as we're talking about it. And this interview took place last year, according to The Independent. I'm not sure how a British newspaper got this, but that's what it is. Oh, it's the disclosure from the New York Times. There it is. And it came just hours after the Department of Justice confirmed that Jeff Sessions, as we reported earlier, was also interviewed. So yeah, if that happened last year, then they're already working... Well, I mean, I guess it would be an easy case to make that they're working on an obstruction of justice case, but maybe he just wanted to debrief Comey on his way out of the White House or out of the administration.
Because suggesting obstruction of justice charges against the president would be the last part of the investigation.
Right.
Or maybe other things besides that, but
well, because if you attack the president, the rest of them will, you know, be able to get away.
Yeah, and he's the highest ranking person. I'm wondering if interviewing Sessions this week was, setting him up to say, you know, to either get him on something else, or to get him online to the. I mean. Could you get the Attorney General online to the FBI? I think you can.
I think so. I don't think it
sells. I don't see why not.
I mean, I'm...
it's a weird one to think about, but... I don't know, but he has other troublesome things. Hopefully he was just... Honestly, he should just be honest. And he might be able to squirrel his way out. I don't know.
Sessions? Yeah, mm-hmm. But he's lied about that so many other meetings and discussions that it doesn't look like he's going to be able to escape scot-free.
So much in front of Congress. It's just ridiculous.
Well, I mean, Congress doesn't care. They've proven that over and over again. You can lie and say whatever in front of Congress, and they will never call you on it.
They might next year.
Yeah, that'll be
watch out with new heads of that. It's not really, I guess, that worth getting into, but the idea if the Democrats took chairmanship of at least one House's committees, much less both, and they're having these, you know, we're still having these kinds of hearings going into next year because, well, shit, let's say in around the time of the election, and I'm just ignoring the politics of the election itself, you know, how it might affect that. Let's say it's just after. Mueller comes to Congress and is like, bam, obstruction of justice. We're recommending these charges for the president. He gives that to the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, which is some Democrat. and they start impeachment proceedings. They're going to be calling in people to be witness to those proceedings, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to be calling in a lot of these folks, Sessions, fucking, I don't know, who else?
Bannon.
Comey. Yeah, all these folks. They lie to the FBI, or they lie to the Congress then. They're going to be brought up on contempt.
Hopefully.
I mean, they're not, they can't get away with it then. So, I
mean, obstruction of justice is kind of the hardest charge, one of the harder charges to prove, so I suspect that all of their, I don't know, shall we say pedestrian criminality will be what probably gets this administration in. There's too much about their ties to organized crime and such for it not to have some substantial, you know, truth to it.
Is there a, you know, I was listening to something about the Watergate investigation, and they brought up how the first ever congressional hearing was a Democrat-chaired committee with this guy who was first elected during the Depression from Texas, and he ran the banking commission, and he was a big-time anti, like, big bank guy. And he first brought the first, what we call Watergate hearing. So eventually, so he's running this investigation. And it gets shut down. And this is months, if not a year, before the big, now famous senatorial investigations into Watergate were held. And the Nixon administration maneuvered to get this thing shut down. They got a bunch of Democrats on their side. No one's quite sure today how. There are rumors. But anyway, where's the banking investigation? The money laundering, the Manaforts, the mob, where is that happening?
Who does that? The U.S. attorney in New York is currently looking at Deutsche Bank.
Okay.
And Kushner's involvement in Deutsche Bank.
Yeah, but
in particular because of that questionable loan right before the election, but...
Oh, yeah. I just mean the Congress, though. Like, I know the intelligence committees are kind of looking into that stuff, but, I mean, shouldn't there be... I don't know if they still have it's the same thing, but some sort of banking commission, finance committee?
I mean, yeah, they have a banking and finance committee. I don't understand. I mean, but it's led by people who have no interest in
exactly
having any of this come out.
Well...
Next year will be a different case, yeah. Hopefully.
So... I wanted to ask you about something. So I think end of last week's episode, we had a little discussion about kind of the Russia investigation taking air away from other conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, and I know you'd be looking at it 2020, hindsight, of course, and you weren't alive for it, but how do you think that compares to, like, Watergate or Iran-Contra or something like that? I mean, was that taking air away? Was it worth it? Was it...
I'd say it was worth it in Nixon's case because it was... He didn't have as broad of a political opposition. For instance, he created the EPA and so many other things. He won with, like, all but, like, two states, if I recall correctly, in his re-election campaign.
You're saying it's almost unnecessary. Because
yeah, it's unnecessary.
There's so many people who hate Trump, and there's so many other things to... Okay.
I mean, like, Russia doesn't matter to these people's lives.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that would be a big difference. I mean, Nixon was...
relatively popular.
Yeah.
As a politician. He won his elections.
Yeah, his enemies list was probably a lot shorter than Trump's would be. that's interesting. So how would you compare it then to...
Iran-Contra?
Would you say kind of the same thing for Reagan then? He was a popular president. There wasn't a lot else to get him on.
They came close.
I mean, there were people indicted, right, because of Iran-Contra.
Yeah, people went to jail for that, as well they should have. But he was... I don't know, it was kind of a... They had flagged, or I guess they draped Reagan, for lack of a better term, in patriotism and nationalism in a way that wouldn't have stuck with Nixon.
Yeah.
If not for that, if not for Ronnie being the cold warrior, I'm not sure he would have he would have gotten out of Iran-Contra as well as he did.
But you're saying that for at least similar reasons it was worth pursuing by...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
But for Trump, it just feels like a giant distraction. Maybe that's just my... I mean, that is entirely my opinion, and maybe it's unfounded, but again, it's taking air away from other issues that are much more substantial and actually affect people's lives.
But now, by that logic, you're almost saying that Watergate and going after him was almost more politically motivated because they didn't have other politically motivated attacks or means of attack.
I would say it's easy to not be politically motivated. I mean, that's objectively a crime. And it was, again, he was politically popular, so they had to get him on, you know, actual provable crimes. And okay, I guess that's okay. Kind of what they're going to go get Trump for, but I suspect that it's not going to be as convoluted as, like, a case of defrauding the United States by keeping the Federal Election Commission from being able to fulfill its obligations and to our democracy. It's going to be something far more pedestrian that does Trump in.
I don't know. I don't know about that.
It's easier to prove.
We'll see. I mean, I don't give Trump much credit for hiding his tracks. The fact that there's decent narratives out there about grounds for, what is it, like, computer fraud, conspiracy, money laundering. I mean, we don't have subpoena power and all that, obviously, sitting here at home, but...
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. there's at least... a basis for suspecting these things, which makes me think that if you did have subpoena power, you could, if there's fire to that smoke, find it. But I see what you're saying, though, about the... I mean, that's what I did want to ask about. It was not so much the facts of the case, but the quote, air it's taking up from other discussions. And that is a good point, is that there's so many other destructive policies that... yeah, it takes some away. I would disagree with you, though, on the grounds for the case itself being any less worthwhile or relevant.
Well, I mean, he should pursue his investigation. Obviously, there's some some suspected criminal activity, whatever.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with a political issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm...
Yeah. Yeah,
unlike some people who are, like, rapidly against Mueller's investigation, even on the left somehow. I'm against the coverage of it for slightly different reasons.
Yeah. I will say, I think it's cooled down, the media coverage of it.
Mm-hmm.
Since maybe, I don't know, November or something? It seems like over the winter it's... It just hasn't been, like, every day, big, huge things, every single media person talking about it. Maybe it's just because there's been other things to talk about that are interesting. Maybe it's the media getting tired of it just as individuals. I don't have an explanation, but I do feel as if it has cooled off.
And it could be part of Mueller's investigation. Maybe he's moving beyond interviews.
Yeah,
and that's why he hasn't had any public interaction for people to, like, grab onto.
Yeah, that was, and the only things you have seen reported in the past few weeks have, for the most part, been Bannon went there, Sessions, like today, went there.
Mm-hmm.
But even those seem to be like a one-day story. It's just like, oh, really? Yeah, that's good to know. And then There's not, like, a ton of extrapolation because of each new revelation.
No.
Which is good. I agree with that. It would be, personally, I would like to know that the congressional committees were doing more and were working together, but that's just not going to really happen with these Republicans, so maybe it's maybe it's futile to hope for that.
I mean, it's tough to see the intelligence and or the Senate and House Intelligence Committee's investigations as, shall we say, nonpartisan. Devin Nunes particularly doesn't seem to be concerned with the truth.
I don't know what he's concerned with exactly. Is it just protect the president at all costs? I mean, what does the president have on him? He just looks like a fool daily for him.
Maybe they hacked the RNC's servers too and are just and used that for blackmail, as some people have suggested.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's no evidence for any of that.
Well, didn't the RNC, or at least people from the RNC, or someone, I thought it was reported that the RNC was hacked, at least, as well. It's just no one released it. I thought that was a true statement that was...
Maybe.
I know Lindsey Graham at one point's like, my emails were hacked as well. Everyone's like... And then there was an earlier recording of him saying he doesn't use email, so everyone was like confused. Like, what? One of these is a lie. Yeah. I don't know if you're going to find any... believable information with a Google search on that one. Maybe though. So anyway, anything to look forward to this week? Before our next podcast comes out, there will have been the State of the Union.
No, it's on the 30th. It's next week.
Yeah, but that's
Tuesday night. I guess it'll be before the next record again.
Yeah, we'll record again, but it won't be out.
Right.
So
okay,
this will be the last one someone hears until that one.
So typically presidents lay out their legislative agenda, but I don't know what he hopes to get through Congress. It'll probably be about entitlement reform, and he'll probably say something about, like Bush did, about the axis of evil, identifying his new axis of evil.
Oh, yeah. He'll probably spend an hour on immigration, honestly.
I would suspect.
If that's in, being debated. I'm sure nothing's going to happen in the next week. By the way, I just saw on Twitter that Schumer rescinded his funding for the wall offer.
Jesus Christ.
So who knows what's happening? I don't even know. Like, part of me is like, fuck yeah, Schumer. The other part's like, wait, what though? Like, what is that going to lead to?
Well, I guess they won't negotiate with the Democrats at all anymore. I guess that's good.
I don't know. I don't know. We're just gonna have to wait and see on that. It's too weird.
I know we talked about this on Twitter, but the International Business Times has just put out a story how laying out direct contributions from a payday lender who benefited from his recent decisions to drop lawsuits at the CFPB and donations to Mick Mulvaney. Let's see, the company World Acceptance Corporation, it's double speak, headquartered in South Carolina, gave at least $4,500 in campaign donations to Mulvaney.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
I mean, does it matter? I guess we'll all be playing that game show this week.
Yeah. Alright, I don't know if there's anything else to go over. Looks like there are still people looking into the Stormy Daniels thing, a citizen for ethics.
I suspect that we'll find out where the money came from pretty quickly.
Well, there's someone on here, Citizen for Ethics. Citizens for Ethics. Have a
documentation of $130,000 transferred from the Trump campaign to the Trump businesses a month after the election. And the, you know, of course, they paid $130,000 to Stormy Daniels a month before the election. As they say in their Twitter post here, could just be a coincidence.
Just a happy coincidence.
You never know. I don't know if anything else. Super Bowl, that was determined. That won't be happening. Also, I'm not even sure who's in it. I don't know. I'm out.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to look forward to, certainly, but...
and world affairs. Let me see if I had any other notes here. All men thus reduced to fleas, so fucking just do whatever you please. For the night commuters in Uganda, little poor crack babies in Atlanta. Nope, I'm good.
Alright,
had a few more notes for their big talking points we can go over next week. Alright, everyone, be good, have fun.
Have a good week.
This has been Tell Me What to Think. I'm Peter Obro.
I'm Charles Minnick.
And you can find me on Twitter at Voter Nemesis and Charles on Twitter at @green_WYRD. Have a good one. Goal of peace. Days of sunny, some days of rain. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains!